Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 10, The Perfection of Upeka, Equanimity, with Jack Kornfield.
The last of these qualities is the quality of upekkha, or equanimity, which means a peace of the heart in the midst of all things. Nati santi parang sukham. There's no higher happiness, said the Buddha, than being at peace with things of the world. And in the course of these 10 qualities, really talked about what it means to remember and embody in our life the qualities of a virtuous heart, of patience and integrity, of the gift of our innate generosity, of loving compassion or dedication. All of these are ways to remember who we really are. So this quality this evening of equanimity or balance speaks most fundamentally about an ease of being. The beloved poet Ryokan, Zen master from Japan, writes, "My life may appear melancholy. Traveling through this world, I've entrusted myself to heaven. In my sack, 3 quarts of rice. By the hearth, a bundle of firewood. If someone asks, what is the mark of enlightenment or illusion, I cannot say. Praise and blame are nothing but dust. As the evening rain falls, I sit in my hermitage and stretch out both feet in answer." Just that simple ease, I stretch out both feet, no opinions, praise and blame, gain and loss, enlightenment and illusion. It is a culmination of these qualities, the heart that is gracious and at ease in the midst of all things. It's really a delicious quality. From the Buddha's teaching, he said, "Some children were playing beside a river. They made castles of sand, and each child defended their castle and said, 'This one is mine.' And they kept their castles separate and would not allow any mistakes about whose was whose. And when the castles were all finished, one child kicked over someone else's castle and destroyed it, and the owner of that one flew in a rage and pulled the other child's hair and struck him and got 2 others to help him. 'He spoiled my castle. Come along with me. Let's punish him as he deserves.' And they came and they destroyed further the child's castle, and they went on playing in their sand castles, each saying, 'This is mine. No one else may have it. Keep away. Don't touch it.' But then evening came. It was getting dark, and they all thought they ought to be going home. No one saw or now cared what became of their castle. They heard the voice of their mother. One child stamped on theirs, another pushed theirs over. The rest were left to the waves, and they turned away and went back, each to their own home." And the meaning of that is in tiny things that we cling to and make and try to possess, and in vast things, so that when the Buddha sat under the tree of enlightenment, first the night of his awakening, he saw 100,000 births and ways that he had been entangled in separateness and possession in all these different forms, or so the story is told. And finally, at the dawning of the morning star, there came this realization of perfection. And he spoke a poem, a song. He said, "O house builder, thou art seen at last. The rafters are broken, the ridge poles are shattered. Nevermore shall you build a house of sorrow. Attained is deliverance, awakened to deathless, to the freedom of nirvana." And the rafters are clinging, and the ridge pole is craving, so that neither forms nor sounds Contacts or tastes, thoughts of any kind, can disturb the heart of such a one. Gained is the heart of deliverance. In each moment of our attention in a deep way, of our awakening, we come to rest in the midst of change. You know from Ecclesiastes, where it is written, to everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. He's speaking of the eternal changes, the seasons of our life and of all of life. And the Buddha spoke about it as the eight worldly winds of gain and loss, of praise and blame, of fame and disrepute, of pleasure and pain. They keep changing all the time, like the waves and the winds. And yet we imagine that if we do it right, we could just get one part of it, only praise and no blame. Anybody succeed? Or only gain and no loss? Praise and blame is so hard. I wrestle with it a lot, you know. And it's hard because we don't trust. We don't trust our own heart, no matter what happens. We don't trust this greater truth that is there, that we can know and rest in, and just let praise and blame rise and fall as it does. One of the things I loved being around my teacher, Ajahn Chah, it was so refreshing. He didn't care what anybody thought or said. He just was himself. And he didn't have conflict with people. He just was true to himself. It's like the story you've heard, maybe. You know, the man who got this note from the furniture company. It said, "Dear Mr. Jones, what would your neighbors think if we had to send a truck to your house to repossess all that furniture that you still have not finished paying for?" And he wrote back the following reply, "Dear sirs, I've discussed the matter with my neighbors to find out what they would think. They all think it would be the dirty trick of a company that they would not want to patronize again either. Thank you." Ah. You know, they always think something, don't they? So why not live one's own life? And that is this quality of listening to one's heart, of being true in the midst of what they think and what comes and what goes. There is a poise or a balance, a spaciousness to it, as from the Tao, easy come, easy go. Thomas Merton's translation of this great Taoist sage Chuang Tzu, he writes, "If a man is crossing a river," could be a woman, but in this case we'll make it a man. "If a man is crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in that boat, he will shout at him to steer clear, and if the shout is not heard, he will shout again and yet again and begin cursing, and all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting, he would not be angry." If you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you and no one will seek to harm you. So simple, that emptying. You can feel it in the story, and this is 2,000 years old, Chuang Tzu speaking. In yourself, the innate capacity to let go, to open, to breathe. Just that. It's all right. And with it, of course, there comes a kind of laughter, you know, to trust in the seasons. I picked up today this little book that says What Women Say About Men. And I found it amusing. I don't know why. This is one of the quotes. It says, "I think every woman is entitled to a middle husband she can forget in between the others." But then somebody answers in reply, "There's so little difference between husbands, you might as well keep the first one." Someone else who says, "Marrying a man is like having something you've been admiring for a long time in a shop window. You may love it when you first get it home, but it doesn't always go with everything else in the house." And in a way, it has nothing at all to do with what I'm talking about tonight. But every time we laugh, it does. It really has that place of equanimity, of just, it's okay, you know. And it's funny. Equanimity is not indifference. The teachings say, and you can find it in yourself, that the near enemy to equanimity is indifference. That is the false equanimity, masquerades as equanimity. And indifference is quite a different quality. It's a not caring, or a fear, an insulation, a withdrawal from the world, you know. So the Dalai Lama, I heard him teaching when he was asked about equanimity. In particular, someone was talking about people using spiritual life to remove themselves from the world, to insulate themselves. So I'm a spiritual person, I don't have to bother with that. And he said, true equanimity and true emptiness is the same as compassion, because it's a letting go of this small sense of self, of this self-consciousness, of this, what we've called the body of fear, and an openness or an expanse of heart and mind, where nothing is claimed as I or me or mine. It's a place of rest in the changing of the seasons. Equanimity knows or discovers the capacity of heart to embrace all things, to move with all things, to be amazed by the new days that come, the new moments, the people that we meet, the light in the trees at this time of year, the mystery of just being alive. And it has in it a kind of light touch, a trust of life. A poem that one of Gil Fronsdal's students wrote. It's like this. There's this bird, and you catch it in your hands. You feel its softness, warmth, its heart rapidly beating. But if you keep holding it tightly, it's no longer a bird, but a corpse. So you open your hands gently, lightly, knowing you can catch it and let it go again and again. That kind of ease, it's not a quality of withdrawal from the world, but a presence and a trust that moves through each moment with a lightness of touch and heart. We don't really know what's going to happen in the next moment or hour or day. No one does. But what we can trust is a kind of natural balance, that we can come back to the center in a moment. My teacher, Ajahn Chah, I remember when I complained to him at one point early on, I was having a lot of difficulty in my meditation. I was always complaining different times. This particular complaint, I'd sort of watch him and say, is he enlightened? You know, is he really acting enlightened or not? Maybe I should find some other teacher. My complaint this day, I said, you know, I don't think you're enlightened. I've been watching. Because you're not, you know, I'm having a hard time in this monastery and I'm watching you and you're not very consistent, you know. You're not even really truthful. Sometimes you'll say this about practice and what you do. Sometimes you'll say that and they're opposite and they're contradictory. How do I know what to trust? And he looked back at me and he said, it's a good thing I don't appear enlightened to you. That would be a real problem. He said, you'd still think that the Buddha was out here. And he's not. He said, but the way I teach is this. There's a road, and I know the road very well. Maybe it's dark or foggy, and I see someone going down the road, and they get often a little sidetracked to the left, or somehow they're about to fall off in the ditch on the left-hand side. And so I shout down to them, "Hey there, go to the right." And I look down a little later, and that same person or another is about to fall off in a ditch on the right-hand side or get lost in some little sidetrack on the right. And so I yell down to that same person, "Hey there, now, go to the left." He said, "That's all I do. Just remind people, come back here to the center." You know how to ride a bike, don't you? The Dharma's the same thing. It is. It's this trust that we have that we can come back to what's here in the moment. And this trust brings great strength and courage. It's really what our sitting teaches us as well. Zen Master Suzuki Roshi, he wrote, "Suppose your children are suffering from some hopeless disease and you don't know what to do. You cannot lie in bed. Normally the most comfortable place would be to lie down. You may pace up and down, in and out, but it doesn't help, does it? Actually, the best way to relieve your mental suffering is just to come and sit in meditation. Even in such a confused state with such grief. And if you've had no kind of experience in sitting with this difficult situation, you haven't really learned the power of practice. Nothing else can appease your suffering but facing it by sitting in the middle of it. And in this continuous practice, under a succession of agreeable and disagreeable situations, you will realize the marrow of meditation and acquire its true strength." It's that kind of trust that comes. Yes, we are here again, we are here again and again. In the midst of all the changes, we can be present. I saw this beautiful big coffee table book of pictures of great black women of America, you know, and I was kind of looking through it, and there was Rosa Parks, who's now quite old, this photo of this luminous, luminous great being in an old woman's body, fantastic, and a little bit of an interview with her, you know, and what she said was so simple. She said, "I just knew I had to sit there and not get up, you know. I just had to sit down and stay on the bus." And it's really, I'd like to get her to come and teach a retreat, basically. It's the same thing. It's that quality of presence in the midst of everything. And an enormous transformation comes from this quality of presence. Equanimity, or presence, which is our Buddha nature, automatically untangles things that are tangled, cleanses, purifies, opens in the face of our pain or doubt or confusion or conflict. It brings a balance in the moment of presence. And any moment of it is incredibly powerful. This moment where we just bow to what is. Ah, you know, it's like that moment when you're fighting with your lover or your spouse or your partner or whatever it is, your business partner. And all of a sudden you wake up and you look at them and say, "We're really into it, aren't we?" You know that moment, and there's a little bit of a smile and you say, "This is what's happening, isn't it? Are you okay? Are you all right?" And in a moment, no matter what's going on, it's just that. It's just this. Incredible power in one single moment of this openness of heart, this attention. In trusting our inner knowing, trusting this quality of presence that's there. The trust in equanimity is not in our ideas and plans and goals and trying to figure it out. Because we can't really. You know, in Zen they say, today's Satori is tomorrow's mistake. Right? You might figure it out today, but then it's tomorrow, and it's new again. Instead, this quality of presence that we find in our sitting and walking and our mindful attention is a kind of resting. Here I read you a poem that's partly for the busy people by this Arab American poet, Naomi Nye, who I love, called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem, remember greasy sausage balls on a paper plate, then reply. If they say we should get together, say, why? It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It'll never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble down any moment. Then decide what to do with your time. It's not the place of plans, but that letting go that makes the space for presence. When we're still, even for a moment, our heart, our mind opens to this vast, eternal silence, this space. It's here, any moment. A moment of equanimity brings us back to that pregnant void, that stillness out of which all things come, which gives birth to everything. Today and yesterday and the 1980s and the 1960s and the 18th century, and all of it came out of nothing. Trooped through for a while and disappeared, right? In a moment, we rest in that stillness that contains all things, yet is not tarnished by them. The Buddha spoke of resting in the eye of wisdom and the crown of understanding, crown chakra, to see 100,000 world systems arise and pass, the wheels of existence. As the Hubble telescope has discovered, 40 billion new galaxies in the last year. They just keep going on and on. 40 billion new galaxies. We didn't know were out there. They might have known we were here, but we didn't know it. And this year, they found, I think, almost a dozen planets circling other stars. First time ever. Hey, guys, you know we're here. Are you out there? Yes. So there's this amazing dance that's that big and that's microscopic and atomic, spinning atoms. This dance of the sun and the moon and the seasons and plants and our bodies and the stock market and cultures and empires, the Sumerian Empire and the Hittite and the Moguls and the Chan and the Mayans and the Ottoman and the Aztecs and the Portuguese. And the English Empire, you remember that one, and the Russian or Soviet Empire, and they come and go. All are called the cycles of samsara by the Buddha, the cycles of the world that turns. And we see, if we look, that whenever they are grasped and possessed, they create sorrow and conflict and greed and racism and war. Whatever part of it we build our sandcastles on and hold to, again and again, creates suffering. And yet this place of knowing, of Buddha nature, sees another possibility. The freedom of heart, where even in the midst of gain and loss and pleasure and pain, in the very struggle of life, there comes the possibility of awakening. Of freedom, of compassion. when we see that we are not some small, isolated part of it, I am all of this and nothing. And even the sorrows are part of the dance. We can sit as we do and invite them to awaken us, to teach us compassion. Here's a poem by Rumi, sage. He says, "This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes in as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival." Fantastic, huh? What a grace, what a spirit of grace to have, because there are so many sorrows and struggles and difficulties and beautiful things that come to us. This friend, poet who died of AIDS, I remember him telling me, "You've all heard the same stories. My body is rotting beneath me, but my heart is growing vast." And he said kind of secretly, like he whispered it to me, "I've learned so much from this. You know, how much this illness has transformed my heart and the community around me." How can we know birth and death, light and dark, sweet and sour, pleasure and pain? "The tears I spilled yesterday have become the rain," says Thich Nhat Hanh. Our tears go into the waters, evaporate, and become the rain to water the earth. Each turns into the next, again and again, our lives always. And then we complain, "Well, it's not the way I wanted it," you know? Anybody ever get it how you wanted it? Please raise your hand. I'd like to meet them, you know? So here is Job, out of the whirlwind, complaining, for a pretty good reason, as a matter of fact, to God. And finally, God answers Job, "Where were you when I clothed the sky, when I placed the suns in their orbits? Were you there when I laid the foundation of the earth, when I set the morning stars to sing together in the sky, when I set the sea with doors to hold it as it gushed forth out of the womb? Tell me, were you there when I swaddled the earth in clouds? Do you know the seasons for the wild ass to bring forth her young, and the day the falcon must learn to fly? Answer me if you can." When equanimity is taught, when this great space of knowing in the dance of life is taught, it is often taught as a balance for the practices of loving compassion. Because in the compassion, if it becomes unbalanced, it's as if we get entangled in everybody's life, how it should be. And the basis for equanimity is the understanding of karma. The chant we would do every morning in the monastery included this reflection. All beings are heirs to their own karma. Their happiness and suffering depends on their actions and not on my wishes for them. It's a very powerful teaching, isn't it? All beings are heirs to their own karma. Their happiness and suffering depends on their actions and not on my wishes for them. No one can love for another person. No one can be enlightened for another person. When we look at it deeply, When we see with the eyes of compassion, we can see that we too have been mother and father and son and daughter. We have been the soldier and the prisoner, the slayer and the slain, the leader and the follower. And depending on conditions, we could face any of these again. How can we judge another when we don't know what the conditions were that brought them to that state? So we look at this birth into human realm with eyes of mercy and compassion and understanding. How can we know? We all live through the same enormous changes of circumstances, of gain and loss, the 10,000 joys and sorrows of birth and death. And it can change in a moment. It's what Stephen Levine likes to talk about, and he calls it big surprise. Something changes. You didn't expect it. Big surprise. I remember this dear friend who was a hospice nurse. For 12 years she worked as a hospice nurse and was a good one, serving people and so forth. And then she was called for a biopsy. And then she had surgery for her cancer. And she said, I couldn't believe it. The alarm, the fear, the sadness, the questions, all that came up in me. I thought I'd dealt with this stuff, right? I never really knew, she said. But now I'm so tender with the people I work with. I'm so caring with each one. Now I really understand. Do we understand this? Because it brings such a tenderness and a respect for each moment, and at the same time a not knowing, a spaciousness. How can we judge or hold? All things change like the seasons, and equanimity knows that we don't own anything. Our ideas, first you're a Republican, then you're a Democrat, or vice versa. You know, then you become a libertarian and then you just give up, right? Do we own our ideas, our bodies, our children, our goods? Story for you. A man and woman went to visit friends in another part of the country right near a racetrack, and they became fascinated and went over and started to bet, little $2 bets all day. Only ended up with $2. The following day, the fellow prevailed on his wife to go over to the course alone. There was a horse with 50-1 odds in the first race. He put down $2. That's all he took with him. Betted on it and won. He put all the money on another horse in another race and won again and kept doing it all evening until his entire earnings came to $57,000. On the way back, he passed a place where there were playing cards. An inner voice, the same that seemed to guide him in the choice of horses, said, why don't you go in? So he stopped and went in. Played one hand, the voice said, yeah, pick a card, this one, number 10, go for that one. He put his entire $57,000 on the card. Then the other cards were turned over, it wasn't number 10. So the man walked back home with nothing in his pocket. His wife called out to him from the porch, how did it go? He shrugged his shoulders. I lost the $2, he said. It's really how it is, isn't it, huh? In the heart of equanimity, we don't own anything. We're just here to respect it for a moment and let it go. And equanimity remembers this in the midst of all of it, that there is another way. So our Buddha nature is not to change life or the world. You can't. But it's this remembering, this awakening, this change of heart, so that what arises, yes, we bow to that too. It's that story I've told of the American couple that adopted the little child from India who turned out to have cerebral palsy and be also profoundly deaf. They didn't know it. Got him a little wheelchair and tried to teach him sign language and learn it themselves. And then they began to feel so sorry for their child. And they wrote back to India and said, he will be really lonely. Could you please send us a second child? And if you wouldn't mind, could you look for one who has cerebral palsy and is deaf? We got one. Could we have another, please? Amazing. And those are sort of the kind of astonishing stories. But I don't think it's far away. It's every moment of forgiveness when we look in the eyes of another person and we just let go and say, it's all right, and bow to them and let them touch our heart and say, we're all in it together. Every moment where we release the sense of being right, of ourself, of the whole body of fear, and just say, it's okay, it's open, it's fine, where we come to peace. I mean, what's the rush? Where are we going? This is the miracle, letting go, compassion, grace, ease. Think about it for a moment, reflect. Where in your own life asks for this spirit of grace, of letting go, of a kind and spacious heart? And how in a moment it can change everything. As the Buddha said in the First Noble Truth, this human life is not without its sorrows. Yet in the midst of all this is a reality that is vast and open, containing all things yet not limited by them, this place of peace, of balance. And it is your birthright, it is your true nature and mine. As Dame Julian of Norwich wrote, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. T.S. Eliot used it at the end of the Four Quartets. I'm doing these interviews, talking to people for this book that I'm very slowly writing on how spiritual practice happens for people. And I remember interviewing this man who is a dear friend and was a Buddhist monk for 25 years and did practice in monasteries of Thailand and Burma throughout Asia, had really deep experiences. And I was saying, well, you know, tell me about them. He said, well, let me tell you about something else. He said, I was meditating, I had visions and experiences of this and that. He said, but then one day, after all that, I was just living simply in this forest monastery and I needed to go to town and I was hitchhiking. So I was a monk and wasn't using money. This pickup truck stopped. It said, yeah, you can get in the back. So I did. I was riding through the countryside. The wind was going through my robes and my hair. It was absent hair, I guess, through my ears. And I was just blowing around, whatever it did. Picture him. Okay, he said, and I was just watching. The sun was shining down. And all of a sudden, he said, it struck me. Every other experience that I had was an experience, but this was different, he said. Everything stopped. It seemed absolutely perfect, exactly as it is. Everything rested in this great wholeness and perfection. And he said, it's as if my heart and my mind just burst open. And there was this tremendous silence and stillness. Even with the wars and the starvation and everything in the world, I knew that somehow that was part of the perfection. And that our compassion and our response to try to do what we can in the face of that was also part of the perfection. And that all there was this reality of the present. It is all we have, is this reality of the present. So when we are faced with the changes of the world, hold them lightly. Like that bird in the hand, don't grasp them. If you can, find that place, remember that place in yourself. As it says in the Diamond Sutra, this very body is the body of the Buddha, and this very land is the holy land. Every step is the step on the holy ground. So the place of equanimity is like the rain. We're in the rainy season, said the Buddha, that rains equally, kindly and openly on the just and the unjust. No, like the earth that receives all things, the place of balance, unmoving. Let your eyes close for a minute as I finish this. Just sit for a moment. And just rest here in the midst of all that's present for you, the pain that you carry and the beauty that's in your heart and being, the memories and feelings and thoughts. Sitting as a Buddha, reflect for a moment on the benefits of a heart at peace, where your heart is balanced and your mind is open, ease. And the prayers for this practice or the recitations inwardly, may I be at peace, or may I have a peaceful heart. May I be undisturbed at all of the events of the world. With the heart open like the sky, may all beings rest in this great stillness, this great peace. May I be at peace. Feel the benefit of living a life from this place of knowing. May I learn to rest in the arising and passing of the joys and sorrows of life. May I be at peace. Breathing gently, letting the mind and heart be spacious and open. A compassion for all beings. All beings are heirs to their karma. Their life passes according to their own deeds. Feel the compassion for them and yourself as well. And may I and all beings discover and rest in this great peaceful heart.
This concludes part 10 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with part 11.